This is Arthur Martin, recorded at his home in Eastleigh in Hampshire on the 28th of June 2010 by Chris Eldon Lee. Arthur Martin, Part 2. I'm intrigued by this, Arthur. This is one of the highlights of your Antarctic collection. If I just...
Oh, yes. Do that. My teeth, yes.
Not your teeth.
No, my set of teeth.
Your victim's teeth.
Lovely teeth, too, yes.
Tell me the story behind that.
Well, Steve and Fred had gone out in the dinghy, and on its way back, Robbie suddenly spotted a leopard seal following them. And as they got nearer to the ice, he yelled, "Get the gun," he said. So we went and got the gun, and he climbed out onto the ice. He took the gun and he said, "Bang!" And he shot it. So we hauled it out onto the ice. And then he started to gut it. And so we had fresh seal meat for quite a while. The head, I had a vision of trying to get it stuffed so I could stick it on the wall somewhere, like a jungle trophy. So I started to flense the blubber off the inside of the head. But unfortunately, I sliced my thumb. And because of the parasites in the blubber, I wasn't able to carry on doing anything for several weeks. And when I came to it, it was too far gone to do that. So I thought, what am I going to do with it now? I must have something. Perhaps I'll have the bone structure. So I boiled it in caustic soda. Well, that was all right, but a lot of the bones disintegrated. So I lost that stage of the bit. But I was left with the jaws. And here was a full set of teeth. So I played the dentist on them and extracted the whole set. Yes, a beautiful set. And they fascinate people. When I occasionally take them round, somebody asks me if I go and chat about the Antarctic, and I take this along. yes, they're a lovely set, and I shall give them to Bess as a souvenir one day.
I presume you had to become quite a dab hand at killing wildlife for various reasons.
Well, yes, the only other two that we ate, of course, were gentoo penguins and the blue-eyed shags. We didn't have many blue-eyed shags, but what we did, we found that the most delightful meat to have, providing you hung it and let it drain off, and then soaked it in salt water to get rid of some of the fish, or vinegar and water to get rid of the fish. But yes, I amuse people when they say, "Well, why do you eat penguins?" Oh, I said, "Yes." I said, "You have a casserole for five people, you need six penguins." Of course, they shudder immediately, thinking of six penguins going. So I said, "Well, when you see 3 or 5,000 on a hill, half a dozen is nothing." But yes, and penguin eggs, of course, we had, which, of course, the penguin is a red yolk, which, of course, you can't fry because they don't set that way. But they make nice buttered eggs, scrambled eggs, and nice pink sponge.
You weren't just feeding yourself, were you? There was also Tiddles.
Oh, well, it was Tiddles. You see, this is one of the blanks in my mind. I knew Tiddles was there because it all seemed to be on top of Jeff's transmitter. But I can never really record it moving around in the base itself. How strange that it must have gone outside. I mean, when we were building the extension, it was up on the roof. I do remember that. But during the period when we were alone, Tettles was up on that transmitter. And I never fed it. I only take it Jeff must have fed it. It was his cat, I think. So that is a strange blank bit, that. At the time, I'd forgotten about Tipples altogether. I mean, he was up there, and I was there. But he was there. And he was, well, he was a part of the establishment. It's just like a furniture fitting. Somebody asked me what happened to him. And as far as I remember, he was still on base when I left. But I do gather that in 1956, he apparently moved off from the transmitter, and it must have been at an angle where it fell on top of him and damaged him. And he never came out of there. But he was taken by Ralph Lenton from Stanley in 1952. So he must have taken it down on the trip that I should have gone down, which, because I stayed in Stanley over Christmas. So that's how he got there.
What were you feeding Tiddles on?
Well, that I couldn't tell you. I mean, it must have been scraps of what we got.
Well, I understood you were killing penguins to feed Tiddles.
Yes, but you only killed them during the time that they were there breeding. I mean, after, when they'd gone north again, there was nothing of that sort. And you were really on dehydrated food and tin food. And there's certainly no whiskers or or cat food supplied. I suppose somebody must have giggled in penguin eggs, probably. Scrambled up with something or other. But as I say, I just don't remember. Somebody fed him.
There was some debate, apparently, about whether having a cat on a base was a good idea. Hope Bay had advised against it because it divided the bay into two camps, the cat camps and the anti-cat camp.
Yes.
Did he remember any angst about Tiddles?
No. I like cats. I always like cats. It was there. It was a part of the establishment. And he was a part of us. Even though, as I say, he was no trouble. No trouble at all. And he survived. Until he met his end, which was unfortunate. But I believe there were other cats in the Antarctic, but that was Tiddles with us.
Tell me about SS Great Britain, because well, actually, no, we'll come back. We come to her later on, because she was in the Falklands, wasn't she?
She was in the Falklands. Right, yeah.
There were some key events that took place while she was down in Port Lockroy, one of which, of course, is a midwinter's day. And we've got here a photocopy of the menu that...
That's right.
..you are partly, if not fully, responsible for.
Yes, I thought I should do something to represent the trades, the crafts, the professions, as it were, of all of us on the base. So I set my mind to think of a display for the front cover, which you can see there was our man horse sledge, the penguin, and a shield which represented the iron sphere. There's the ionospheric card, the aerials, the weather bits.
Anemometer and weather vane.
That's right. So that really said this is us, which was, I suppose, our symbol, as it were. Yes. And I thought, well, is my pen and ink coming again? And then the programme, of course, developed as the day went on. There was the round robin of bases, and there was a chess game going on, and we were passing greetings to one another. There was a midwinter message from the governor of the Falkland Islands, which we all listened to. And it was a very happy day. We also enjoy food, of course. And that's the thing about food, I think, in those days, because the amount of food was somewhat regular. I mean, it followed a pattern about a 4-week pattern, then you started the four-week pattern again, or you could shift it so that it changed. But you knew roughly what the big bits were. It was tongue one week, it was ham the next week, brisket of beef the next. And so what do you do with it? And you can turn out the same old thing week after week, but you can soon get bored with that. And so I think the art of the cook of the day was to see how he could improve what had gone before, and you could create a new dish. And I think that was everybody's challenge. I mean, some were better than others. Some enjoyed experimenting. And I well remember the first time I made my bread. I'd never made bread. I'd made dampers, a scout damper, which is a camp bread. But I'd never been to it. And it didn't rise. I was very disappointed then. But second attempt, it did. And there was no looking back after that. The baking every other day, yes. Yes, it was great.
And here's the menu for that Midwinter's Day
yes.
meal in 1953 at Port Lockroy. A rather international menu, I'd have thought there, Arthur, with French, English and Scottish elements.
Yes, I
and Belgian.
My French wasn't terribly good, so I sought help with that. So it was in a way, a combined effort to get it. I mean, I sowed ideas, and together we put it together and had the meals, as the menu says.
Christmas pudding is pudding de Noël à l'anglais avec crème à Nestlé.
Yes. Well, again, it was. I suppose it's evaporated milk. Doctored up, as it were.
What on earth is Port Stanley Rock?
Ooh.
Is that Blackpool Rock?
No, I think it was Port Stanley Rock. Somebody brought it on the way down. They'd never eaten it, but produced it for Midwinter. So it was a piece of Port Stanley Rock, one of the sweets, as it were.
And it seems that you gathered round to listen to the radio a couple of times in the day. 1:30, calling the Falklands. 5:15, the Miles Clifford address.
Yes. Which was relayed out from Stanley, of course. And then Jeff just kept, you know, twiddling in, twiddling out. And so he picked up this and picked up that throughout the day. And we shared base to base as the day went on.
He also picked up the two other royal events, two royal events. One was the death of Queen Mary, which apparently took place shortly after you got there.
Yes, strange enough, I don't remember a great deal about that. I suppose that was a bit where I was. I can't remember now, but it obviously happened. But it was one of those things at the bottom of the earth. You weren't conscious of it happening. You weren't there anymore. So that one really slipped by. Was an event nationally, a great mourning, of course. No, life went on, and the poor soul had passed away, and she was at peace. But the other one...
That's June the 3rd, the coronation.
Yes. Now, that's strange, you see, because... the coronation day, the official day, I think, was the 2nd. However, the Antarctic official day was the 3rd. And the post office had to mark all the first day stamps the 3rd of July. This is very odd. I mean, I'll show you some stamps.
Please do.
You've got them, have you?
According to this, there were two base members who got up to listen to the coronation of the Queen on the radio at 6 a.m. Do you remember doing that?
Well, I would have got up at 6 anyway to do a med op.
Right.
So I would have been about, yes.
So listening to the coronation was a secondary attraction.
yes. That's right. I do remember that day I hoisted a new Union Jack. and I brought it home with me when I came out of base. It wasn't much left of it, but we celebrated I took, being a royalist, I took out a new Union Jack and flew it. And that evening, Robbie had found in the store some gunpowder. So we thought we should have a firework display. So we built up a great big base in the ice and with a stream out, which he touched off, and away it went, and boom, our firework display to celebrate Coronation Day.
Were these fireworks you manufactured, or were they merely explosions?
Oh, it was just a mass of gunpowder.
A big bang.
Yeah. I mean, that was Robbie's pitch. He found it. He knew what he was going to do with it. And he did.
The other event that day, of course.
It was a great day, that.
The other event that took place or was announced on that day, of course, was the conquest of Everest. And that, did that reach you, that news reach you?
Yes, it did. Yes. I mean, it was a great day. It was a great achievement. And everybody rejoiced in that.
Did you meet Fuchs?
Yes. Not until afterwards, either reunion. And of course, then I met him several times when I was on the Bass Committee, which I did 8 years of that. And occasionally he came to meetings. And it was always a pleasure to see him. There was something about the man.
How do you mean?
It was sort of an inspiration in the man's face. You know, you could almost be picked up by it. He shone something, exploration, expeditions, ventures into the unknown. But there was a character in his face which I think was a light. At least I could see it that way anyway. I suppose some people see things in people and others don't, but I should always remember his face. Yes, he was a character.
The other character you met was Frank Elliott, of course, who was Sec Fids.
Oh, yes, yes.
Tell me about him.
Well, yes, he was, as I told you, my first encounter with him about what I was not going to do Met, but I was going to do Met. And then when I came home in 1954, I was hoping to go back to Discovery to take up my post, but the association found it couldn't afford to keep it, and it certainly couldn't afford to do the renovations which were necessary. And so they decided they were going to have to get rid of it. And when I came home, she was in St. Catherine's Dock. And I went to have a look at her. And there was no job there for me at all. So I came home with no home and no job. I went to stay at the Scout Settlement in East London for a while. And eventually I met up with the young lady who I'd met at the age of 9. She was, as you say, there for me for life. That was the girl I wanted. But we had become engaged during the war. She was in the Wrens and I was in the Navy.
Mrs. Beryl.
Yeah. But she was of the Roman Catholic faith and I was of the Church of England. And she said it wouldn't work, and I said it would. It wouldn't work, it would. And eventually we parted company, but as friends. And then some time went by, and when I came in 54, I got in touch with her again, and it blossomed. But here was I, with no home, no parents, very little money, in the prospects of getting married. So I thought, what am I going to do? So I thought, well, I could go back in the ice for 2 years. I can't spend money down there. At least I should have something to get married on. But before I came home, Gordon Hawkins, who was the chief Met officer, said, if you're down this way again, he said, want a job, he said, I might find you one in the office. So when I went to see Frank, I said, look, Gordon said there's a chance of a job. He said, well, we can't do anything about it here. The Crown agents can't do that. You'll have to arrange that when you get south. He said, you might get lucky, you might not. So I left in the June of 54 with a chance of either staying in Stanley or going south again for 2 years. When I got to Stanley, I went to see Gordon and said, things have changed since I last saw you. I said, I've become engaged. I wanted to get married. There's only chance of staying here.
Mm. But Beryl was a Falklander, was she?
No, she was lived in Luton. Oh, in Hitchin, in Bedfordshire, Hertfordshire. He said, strange enough, he said, we've got somebody in here who's dying, bursting his boilers and wants to go south. He said, if you can pick up his job in 3 months, he said, he can go and you can stay. He went, I stayed. And when I stayed, of course, I got in touch with Beryl and she said, I'm coming. And her father sent her out as a wedding present. And she arrived in February 55 and we were married in 55.
So the Met job with Hawkins was in Stanley.
Yes.
Beryl was sent south to marry you.
Yes, she came out on the Andes as far as Montevideo and then the Fitzroy to Stanley. And I managed to rent a house in John Street, which was our home then for 3 years. And Gordon Hawkins was my best man, and Frank Elliott gave Beryl away in place of her father.
Tell me a bit about Gordon Hawkins. I did go and interview him a few years back. He's now passed away, of course. But what do you?
Has he? Well, I mean, it's strange. I kept in touch. Well, we kept in touch with Ina and Frank and Susan, who was the daughter, over the years. I'd written several times to Gordon, but I never got a reply for some unknown reason. And I wrote again, I suppose, 2 years ago now, but I never got a reply. So I thought, well, he doesn't. He's either dead or doesn't want to renew acquaintance. But I hear regularly from Frank, who's 94 or 5 now. His wife's died some years ago. Susan's in Hawaii. And he has a granddaughter who keeps an eye on him regularly.
What did he make of Gordon Hawkins?
Gordon, he was a friend as far as I was concerned. He watched over the work I did in the Met Office, which I enjoyed. I mean, I wouldn't call myself a meteorologist, but I picked up what I had to do. And I enjoyed doing what I did. I used to draw the maps and charts for Sam Glassie to do the forecasting on, and I used to do the balloons and so forth, and all the other rigmarole. But I only did it for 9 months. Treasury, which were the FIDS accounts, were looked after by the Colonial Treasury, but they could never get the information they wanted. So Frank said, would you take them over? So I took them out of the Colonial Treasury into the hut alongside the town hall there, which the army using now as a bomb disposal headquarters, and set it up there with Ingrid Pettersen, who was a member of, who was looking after with me in the Colonial Office until we moved. And we set it up there. And that was going very well until they sent out Bill Tinsley from the Colonial Office. I hadn't got the school tie, and so of course he took charge, and I continued doing the work I knew he did, but he took over from there, and I left him with it when I came home in 1957. But yeah, they were happy days.
I'm right in thinking that you were instrumental in actually establishing the Treasury.
Yes.
The FITS.
Yes.
What happened before?
Well, I mean, by and large, it was there, but in the Colonial Treasury.
Right.
And Ingrid worked on it as a part of the Colonial Treasury's staff. And then when I moved, when he asked me to do this, I went in to pick up the strings, as it were, and then we sort of lifted it up, as it were, and took it down to the hut. So it was a follow-on, but it was running the routine instead of it being done by the Colonial Treasury.
What a challenging job was
it? Well, it was, yes, because I'd had accounting experience both in the Cambridge Examination Syndicate in Mill Lane, in the accounts department there, and then my time with the County Treasurer's Office, which is when I first...
In Cambridge?
Yes, which is when I came into the punch card system. Pre-computer world.
What were the challenges in Stanley then for the Treasury, the new Treasury?
Well, I suppose getting to grips with it and then keeping it up to date and having material ready for when somebody says, how's the situation now? Instead of waiting for the Colonial to deliver it, we could almost do it the same day. It was an instant rather than having to wait the time of the Colonial Treasury to produce it.
What were the parameters of your books? What were you actually accounting for?
The invoices which were allocated, I mean, they were coded off. So it was coded and entered into the registers under the certain codes. There was salaries, fixed pay and so forth, expenses and so forth. So it was following the normal accounting routine.
But it was purely for South, if you like, for...
Yes.
Stanley, yes. And for Stanley, for the basis. Yes. You weren't dealing with anything in the London office.
Well, because it wasn't very big in those days.
No.
I mean, it was basically in Stanley.
Mm.
It wasn't until, 56, 57, that they came up to Greyfriars, was it? They had an office there, and then it began, and it developed there, and, of course, it eventually went to Cambridge. So that was it. And during that time, I took on the IGY account, which was a separate account from Bass, or FIDS, as it were. So I looked after that, and I did some work on that when I came home on leave in 57, thinking I was going back in October, but I never did.
Were you following the IGY on the radio?
On and off, yes. Life in Stanley in those days was fairly hectic in a way. I had a daughter then, as I progressed on after marriage. I had my peat to cut during the summer period. So after work at night, I used to get out of my peat bank and cut my peat and pack it up for drying out. And there was always work to be done about the house, so life was that. And then I became one of the panel of local newsreaders. And every Friday evening you had a half an hour to give local news, which you had to glean during the week. And that brought me again in contact with the community. I became a Sunday school teacher in the church. I did some restoration work on one or two of the glass windows which were broken, which I replaced with clear glass because there was no stained glass. And I coloured it and varnished it. And as far as I know, it's still there. So, I entered the life. I tried to start scouting there, and I went to see... the governor then was Oswald Arthur, and I said, I'd like to start scouting here. He said, what I will allow you to do, if you can start rover scouts, the age of 17 upwards, he said, you can go ahead, providing you can find a local leader.
Mm.
He said, there's really not room for two organisations in Stanley, and I understood that. So, of course, I didn't. I couldn't find anybody to take over. There were one or two people who'd been in the movement before, but I couldn't get them to move. However, I did go back in 91 to train the then scouters of the group, and I spent 6 weeks there training them.
In Stanley?
In Stanley, yes. Yeah. Yes.
So back in 54, 55, what was your house like in Stanley? Where were you living, in fact?
Living in 36 John Street. Which was one, two, three, four rooms downstairs with a larder and four bedrooms and a bathroom and and a toilet, which was also a large room with a toilet in one corner. yes, but it was a nice house. I rented it, and the people to whom I rented it, we've kept in touch with ever since. The parents are all dead, of course, and now the only person left now is the daughter, who was the younger of the children. Her brother, who was the next one in line there, died last year, and the one elder than that, Ronald, he was in an accident with his lorry. It moved back and got him, and he's paralysed from the waist down, and he's hospital case for the rest of his life. Very sad. He was a farmer.
So you got to know two governors in Stanley. You got to know.
Yes. Well, I knew. Yes. If I suppose I knew Miles Clifford, but only very basically. The one I did know, of course, was Oswald Arthur.
Tell me about him. Tell me about him.
Well, I could say a gentleman, inasmuch that he was a very upright, broad figure, white-haired, always had a happy outlook on his life. He always recognised you, ready to speak, ready to how things were. And we invited him to the wedding, and he came. And, of course, in those days, we were invited, as being part of the government set, to Government House dues. And that was a strange thing. This is one item that Beryl didn't like, because it was them and us. Mm. There was the colonial set and the local set. Now, I reckon we steered what I thought was a middle path, because I had community connections, and of course I had the Government House connections. And so if you could blend those together, you could live in peace with all.
Did you meet Mrs. Clifford?
Mrs.
Clifford, Miles Clifford's wife?
No, I didn't, okay. No.
All right. Interesting character apparently, but never mind. There's one or two other things I wanted to ask you about, if I may.
Yes.
After you'd left Portlochroe, they actually discontinued the Met work, didn't they?
Yes.
No Met man went in to replace you.
I think mine was a privileged role. I mean, I think it was a softening for me, because that's what I thought I was going to do. But then I was told I was going to do what I was sent to do. And I think that was a softy bit. But I mean, enjoyed it. I mean, I went there to do it, and at least I had an opportunity to do my bit of Met. It stopped when I left.
So the readings you were taking were not that critical then, really?
Well, there was, I suppose in the collection of war material south, probably insignificant. It might, I don't know. I mean, I did it, sent it off, and then people further up the line knew what they were doing with it, did with what they wanted to do with it. I mean, you never knew whether it was of real value or not. Mm. But then you have to say, is that the same on all stations, really? You can only observe and record what you've got on hand and what you can see and the instruments you've got with. And how it fits in with the rest of the pattern to provide weather forecasts for the whaling fleets and others using the area it covers.
Did you get any sense of why they didn't continue with it?
No. I suppose I never gave it a thought. I mean, once I left, my concern was to get back to pick up the job so that I could continue with now first-hand knowledge of having been there.
on the discovery. Yeah.
That's right, yes.
And you were thwarted.
Well, I was thwarted, yes. It was not to be.
And I need to ask you about chess as well. I know we're darting about a bit, but let's go back to Lochroy.
Oh, yes.
Because inter-bass chess became something of a tradition for a while, didn't it?
It did, but I didn't play chess in those days, no. I didn't learn chess until I came home in 1954 on the Martiness, a Danish charter vessel, which went from Stanley to Tilbury, non-stop. And the chief engineer there said to me, "Do you play chess?" I said, "No, but I'd like to." He said, "Oh, well, we'll teach you it." And so, you know, on the voyage home, 42 days of it, we had a session of chess every day. And that's how I picked up the chess business.
So whilst the games of chess were taking place via the radio with Bases F&H from Base A,
yes,
this was all gobbledygook to you, was it?
Well, yes, it was. I mean, I knew it was taking place, but I didn't follow it because I didn't understand it.
Rumour has it you were a dab hand at Monopoly, though.
Ah, well, yes, I had played Monopoly over the years. The luck of the draw, perhaps I was lucky, yes. But it's an enjoyable game, and whiled away some of the evening at spare time, yes.
You were described by one of your compatriots as a bloated plurocrat it came to Monopoly. In other words, you were very good at it.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. I wonder who said that. Well,
I'll tell you later.
Yes, but it's very interesting, yes. I've always admired good things. I suppose, yes. I mean, part of my life was in the Fitzwilliam Museum, so I grew up with great paintings, great treasures of art and craft. And I've always enjoyed that, as I do good music, although I can't play an instrument, only a gramophone.
Let me go back to my question about SS Great Britain, because
yes,
you're in the Falklands now, and this is, in fact, where you went to see her, because she was there for a while.
Yes, indeed. She was in Sparrow Cove, which was round the corner, as it were, from the main harbour. And occasionally we used to take a rowing boat out and pull out round to Sparrow Cove and get ashore, and then, because she laid in the cove there, part was underwater and part wasn't, and occasionally we would climb one or two of the timbers and admire the wreck, I suppose. But it was something to be seen. It was a part of the history of the island. So it was an adventure out again, you know, it's a pulling boat raid occasion, and a company of somebody else. We enjoyed doing that. But yes, I didn't see her come back. Life carries you on, and some things you don't see. But I knew she was being brought home.
Were you gobsmacked at the idea of bringing her back?
Well, yes. I mean, how on earth could they pick it up and bring it all the way? I mean, it's a feat in itself. I mean, it's incredible, really. But here it was, it came. And then some years later, Bear and I went to Bristol, went and had a look, and we were amazed. We met one or two people that we knew of and about, and so we went once or twice, but I haven't been for some time now, and not since almost they completed it. But strangely enough, one of the people responsible from the architectural point of view was a man called Tiny Parr, who was a member of the service team on the Royal Research Ship Discovery when I was there. We had a strong band of volunteers, and he was a shipwright architect by profession. He was an old Etonian, so he knew what he was talking about. And he'd done a lot of work on that, and I've been in touch with him over the years. He had friends in Fareham that he was in close contact with. So I'm looking forward, hopefully next year, of actually might see her again.
This is at the Bass Club reunion in
Bristol. Yes, yes, I hope I might make that one.
some philosophical questions, if I may, and if you can't, if you don't want to answer, just don't worry. No, I'll move on. You mentioned about becoming an orphan and becoming quite an independent soul quite early on.
Yes.
And I wonder whether that was helpful later in life when you found yourself working not only with FIDS but also with the Scout Association.
Yes,
dealing with difficult situations, harsh environments, isolation.
Yeah, I think it. Well, I think it did. Loneliness, if you call it loneliness, I don't suppose really hit me until my mother died.
Mm-hmm.
And although we were not all that close together because of the circumstances, I was very fond of her when I was with her. And I suppose when she died, and I saw her almost before she died, and she was in one of these oxygen things, and as a young child then, I was terrified of it. And I suppose then it hit me, and I felt very much alone. And I suppose I cried, and I could still cry. And all through life, I went on thinking, now I must get it. And strange enough, it was buried down below. Seemed as if she'd taken a part of that life. I never told her that, but... there was something I wanted, and I wanted to be with her, near her, at times. And I won't tell you all the little details, how I waited and tried to see if she would be here, and she wasn't, she was somewhere else. And that's how that attachment for me to her has been all my life. But through life, yes, I've had to learn that if you want something, you have to strive for it, against odds. My aunt was not in favour of me being a scout for some reason or other, and I did too much scouting while I was with her, and eventually we parted company, and I went into digs when I could afford to do that. So that was determination on my part. I knew where I wanted to go, although I thought I knew where I wanted to go. I mean, the war changed my life again. And that was an experience of, as any person who went through the war will tell you, either at home or in the field of action. But then you're living day by day, and you're looking for the next day because you're actually alive to carry it the next day on. And I think that's been something that's gone on in my life. Even now, I wake up in the morning and I say to myself, what are you going to do today, Arthur? What are you going to achieve? What bits can you do? And I stand to put together one of the things. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. At the end of the day, I might say, well, did I achieve it? If not, well, I've done something. And I've achieved something. Same as today, I'm doing some archive work. And every day I add a bit more to it. So I achieve something every day. And I think that's one of the great things about life. You must have something to move you on all the time.
And can you tie back that drive in your life back to the unfortunate circumstances of your early years? And in terms of the Antarctic, in a strange way, did the difficulties in your early life actually steel you to cope with the Antarctic?
Yeah, well, that was a part, I think, of living the life I lived. It lived the skills I picked up through life. It picked up those silly things that scouts do as interests, and the way of life in camp and working together as a group of people. And they really came to life in the world, you know. Mm. Here you were in a place where you've got to cook for four other people and yourself. Or and you had to make something of it, and it's got to be worth having.
Mm.
That's right. And if I'd had to use that wretched surgical thing tray in that medical box, I pray to God it never happened. And thank goodness it didn't. But, you know, that would have been a challenge as well, whether I had to cope with it. I suppose I would have done, because, you know, you were there and there was no other alternative.
Exactly. Yeah. It sounds as if your education might have been affected by your childhood as well, the lack of parents. And I wonder whether...
It was a lack of education.
Lack of education.
And it's gone on through life. What I've done, I've tried. I went to technical college. I thought I was... One of the things I wanted to do, become a personal secretary. I had an ambition to be a personal secretary. So I took up shorthands and typing. But I had another leisure in there. I was a great folk dancer. And folk dancing and scouting got in the way of education. But life is about education too. And I've always tried to better myself. And that's why I've always accepted challenges when somebody said, will you do this? I do it. Because at the end of it, I should have gained something. Although I should have contributed, I should have gained something. And I think that is what has really taken me through life today. Today, I mean, I still look for odd challenges. I've got things I want to do. In the church, I stopped being a church warden, but I'm an elder, as it were. They know if they want something and they're in a fix, they only have to say Arthur. Things I do, again, with my skill of my writing and that. And so I go through life that there are challenges there, and I do them. As I show this week, I shall be writing baptismal cards for 8 godparents, the child, and the registers, etc. But I shan't see it. But it'll all be there for the vicars to carry on.
So the fact that your education was incomplete,
yes.
Yet you still managed to become a key figure in the treasury, both in Cambridge and in Stanley.
Yes. I must have had a mind for figures.
All oh, right, okay.
Or figures obviously interested me. Again, it was a way of life. It earned me money to do the other things I wanted to do. But I enjoyed what I did, as I did at Fitzwilliam Museum. But scouting got in the way of that. It was a weekend work occasionally, you see, and that stopped me going to camp.
So scouting was your salvation and your downfall?
Well, it was, yes, both ways, if you like, yes.
There were just 5 of you on the base that winter at Fort Lockroy.
Yeah.
And very in those days, no visits in winter. So I wonder how you handle the isolation between the 5 of you.
I often think that when I say that it was a happy base, apart from that one incident which I told you about,
the slamming of the door.
Yeah, the slamming of the door. We all had a job to do, and we all got on with it, and it seemed to take the day. And if you weren't doing that, you were doing one of the other tasks of the day. If you were cook for the day, you had your own work to do, but you had to fill in the cooking business. And there was the other domestic things, which was all part of life. So, you know, you were involved in things, and then there was the respite, where you listened to the music, or you wrote letters or did other things and enjoyed the music. You played Monopoly or other board games. Strangely enough, you did very little talking and sharing about individual background. That I found coming out now, looking back. I should have known more about Steve, of Fred, of Jeff. I was asked to write the obituary for Jeff. And I had to search for that, so I actually got to know more about him, and then I got in touch with his wife. Didn't even know he was married. You know, that was how close you were, but you weren't close as a complete. You were close of 5 people in an active role in the maintenance and operation of a base. And I think that was it. And you made the best of it and enjoyed what you did.
So do you think you benefited from the fact you had diverse backgrounds, or was that irrelevant almost?
Yeah, well, I think so, yes. I mean, as I said to you earlier, you know, that was 5. It's like a patrol of scouts.
Mm.
Each had something positive to contribute. And I'm sure, in addition to the skills that they took in for the base work, there were other skills that came to light, such as my first aid, my cooking skills, that made part of the life of base, which kept it happy. Yes.
Any swearing? Sometimes men hold up together?
Strangely enough, very little. No. I mean, it's, when you look today, it's easy because the life is full of it. But somehow it wasn't. Perhaps that was why it's a happy base.
It was all a bit proper, wasn't it?
It was, yes, it was proper. People behaved as people, and as not as loudmouth expressionists.
There's one very proper occasion, of course, when you had the royal visit. And here's a photograph.
Ah, that was in Stanley.
The Duke of Edinburgh arriving at the public jetty with Oswald Arthur.
57, I think, wasn't it? 56, 57.
Did you meet him? Prince Philip?
Yes.
Were you there?
Yes. He was doing that southern tour of Commonwealth, I think. And he put on his itinerary the Falkland Islands and a visit to Antarctica. And when he arrived, of course, everybody went mad. Well, they were driven to mad. Children never weighed Union Jacks before, and they were lined up in the street and told to shake their flags.
I wonder where they got them from.
Well, that's right. They've never done it before. So, I mean, there was a great exchange, an experience for them. But, yes, I mean, he had a great time when he was there, and everybody did. He visited Fidd's office, and in true naval condition, he knew where to look. He opened a cabinet and everything fell out because everything had been stuffed inside. And he opened it. He said, oh, I thought so. Laughed like a drain, as he always would. Yes.
You mentioned the Bass Club Committee, which you were on for 8 years.
Yes.
And going to some reunions and hoping to go to the next one. How important now is the Bass Club Committee to you as a retired, long retired Fidd?
Well, I think yes. Whilst Bass Club remains a Bass Club, and I can't see the thing folding. I mean, because it's a perpetual thing, isn't it? Whilst they're Antarctic bases, and there'll always be people who want to gather together. I mean, in those days, I was working, and then I retired, and I lived in this part of the world, and I motored to Cambridge and back the same day, and people said, you're crazy. And in the latter years, when I'd retired, I actually did start to go by train. Again, I found it interesting work, in as much as I questioned a number of things that were being said, and I did actually question the Constitution.
What year was this, roughly?
I can't remember whether it was 80, it must have been 86.
Mid-80s, yeah.
Mid-80s, I think.
Yes, you questioned the Constitution, which of course was a serious mistake, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And Peter said, well, I think you should draft it. And so I drafted the Constitution that followed that earlier one. And then I was, of course, delighted when I saw that they were going to look at the Constitution again. But it's changed. I mean, Bass had changed then. It developed on, as you would expect it to do that way. I think it's doing a lot of good work. It's certainly helping to provide for the needs of others. And it may be shortly I might actually be making an approach because of one of the Fidd's office, Stanley, who now lives there since age 70, has just had a stroke, lives alone, and it might be that occasionally she may want a bit of support. But until we get an assessment of her condition later on, we shan't know. But that's a good thing, because it takes care of relatives of those who are not so fortunate.
Did you revolutionise the Constitution, or was it just a case of minor revision?
I looked at the Constitution when I saw it, and I thought, well, then some of it's not relevant any longer, you know. It needs bringing up to date with where we are today. And so I took the old one and thought about it and rehashed it. And then eventually went to committee and they put it to the annual meeting and it was accepted. So I'd made my little... I'd made my mark.
I moved on. I can't ignore your MBE in 1991, even though it was not for polar services but for scouting services.
Well, it was, yes, it was scouting and youth work. And
sounds like that came out of the blue, rather.
Well, it did, yes. I mean, until I got the letter from the Prime Minister saying that being recommended for this, would I accept? I hadn't the foggiest idea. I'd already got the Silver Wolf, which was the highest award by the Chief Scout in scouting. I mean, I'd reached that and I didn't want it. I mean, whatever award I've had is not mine. It's what I carry for the work of those that I've been engaged with and are actually doing the work face to face. The same with the MBE. It's not mine. It belongs to those who I had privilege to work with.
You're in the unique position of being able to compare one organisation with another. And this is a slightly cheeky question, but I think you'll get the drift. Was FIDS as organised in those days as a scouting association, or was the reverse true? Which was a better an organisation? Was FIDS organised in the 50s?
Well, I mean, as far as I understood it, yes, it was well organised, doing the job it had to do. And over the years, that organisation has obviously changed, as it has in the movement that I belong to. And you look back and say, my God, you know, where are some of those fundamentals gone? But actually they're there, but in a different version. And the time, the conditions, the language, the ethos is there, but it's changed, it ripples more. And perhaps, I suppose it's more appealing to young people. Well, I say that because we had a time when the movement began to lose its momentum. It's now on the way up. It's growing 4 or 5% a year, back on the 500,000 mark in this country, which can't be bad for a youth organisation these days.
But when you moved from one organisation to the other in the 1950s, was one better run than the other?
No. I mean, there's a saying, once a scout, always a scout. And that continued with me, the ethos, the purpose of living as a scout, combined by the promise and the law we make as a boy. And I suppose that carried on through life in FIDS, because it took me and all I stood for with it, and perhaps I tried then to contribute me to that, and so that what I did, perhaps a bit of me rubbed off onto others, they then perhaps understood me better, and I helped to understand them better. And so, again, it was a sharing, as it is today. Everybody I meet, and the people will say, oh, I see you're wearing a scout badge. And I say, yes, were you? Oh, a long time ago. I said, well, you still are. Would you like to shake my left hand? You see, you can't forget it. Neither can they, if they're honest. It stays there. It's a way of life for betterment of a world in which we live.
Your other organisation, of course, is the church, and I wonder how you were able to fulfil your church-going needs in your year at Port Lockroy, whether you had to put it on a back burner for a while, or did you find a way?
The way I would say, or to answer that, is that it was probably in meditation. And as the incident I told you, where I thought I saw this vision of Christ in this optic phenomena, perhaps at times he was not there, but then you have to say in life, sometimes he's never there, is he? But sometimes you feel close, and sometimes you know he's there, but you can't reach, you can't see. But you know there's something there which is purposeful.
in a room with four other men with a generator running in the background all the time, was it sometimes difficult to reach that meditative state?
Difficult at times. I think difficult at times. I wonder what the next 20 years is going to bring. I shudder at times. But then I have faith in young people. And I think young people won't let us down. If they do, it's on their blooming heads.
A lot of chaps I talk to do regard their time in the Antarctic as being something very, very special in their lives. Some of them will say it's the best years of their life. How do you rank it at those 3 or 4 years with FIDS?
It's an experience I welcomed. I shall never forget. I said in an article I wrote for the magazine, I think I came out a better man than I went in, because I reinforced some of the values that I had and some of the ways I operated. And that was strengthened upon men of different varieties, although I'd experienced that during the war, but not perhaps quite so shut off as you are in the Antarctic with four other colleagues. So, yes, it was a wonderful experience and one, you know, I've treasured and always happy to share with other people, because I think they should understand that people do actually still today go into places where things are vastly different, and you have to do a job and you have to learn to live with other people and get on and come back having made a contribution, both to what you're doing and to yourself.
That's a good answer. I think we'll leave it there.
Right.
Arthur, thank you.
Pleasure.